The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. The first month of your membership is only 99 cents. Sign up today at Gaia.com/gym. Thanks, Gaia. This podcast is also brought to you by Club W. Club W is offering our audience members 21 and over and who live in the U.S. $25 off their first order and free shipping on 4 bottles of wine as a new member of Club W. To take advantage of it, go to clubw.com/gym. Thanks, Club W.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you. And boy, we are on the cusp of a big Halloween weekend. Somebody told me that it's almost like a four-day Halloween weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. All Halloween, all the time. And in fact, this Halloween season, I had so many interviews for the Paranormal Podcast that were related to the supernatural, the strange, things perfect for Halloween. I couldn't fit them all in the shows that we had. So guess what? We just, we did what they do in the newspaper business. We printed it some more pages. We're actually, this is a bonus edition of the Paranormal Podcast, absolutely free. And today we have a great show. We're going to talk to the husband and wife paranormal team of Greg Newkirk and Dana Matthews. They're kind of married to the paranormal with their various websites and their museum of the strange that they have. And we're going to talk to them about that life and why they find it so fascinating. The Museum of the Paranormal and Occult, to be exactly correct. And then we're going to talk to Tony Spera. He is the son-in-law of Ed and Lorraine Warren. We're going to find out an inside view of the Warrens, who, of course, kind of predated all of this paranormal investigation and were some of the very first folks to do it. So there you have it, a bonus edition of the Paranormal Podcast. Let's not delay and get right to the content, and happy Halloween. We have two great guests on the line for this time of year, because this time of the year, September and particularly October, are about the weird. And we have two people. Well, they describe themselves. Now, I didn't say this. They describe themselves as professional weirdos. I'm talking about Greg Newkirk and Dana Matthews, and they are the brains behind two paranormal sites, weekandweird.com, which is kind of their lead site, and then weirdhq.com. And if you go there, they've got great content and paranormal stories, really a beautiful sites and a lot of good content to back it up. And we thought it'd be great to visit with them a little bit, talk about the sites and what's interesting them in the weird today. Greg and Dana, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, and let's say ladies first. Dana, what got you into the paranormal? Is this something that goes way back to when you were a little kid? Did it come, you know, as you got into high school and college? I mean, when did you become a weirdo like the rest of us?
I like to think that I was born a weirdo, but my interests in the paranormal have always been from a kid. I sort of started off being obsessed with Bigfoot and ghosts. And then by the time I reached about 20, I realized that people were actually going out and investigating this stuff. And that was sort of the first few steps into actual paranormal investigation I took. So yeah, I've always kind of been fascinated with the paranormal. It's, again, something that I've sort of been obsessed with ever since I was a kid. Yeah.
And Greg?
Pretty much the same thing. I mean, my friends and I decided one night we wanted to go vampire hunting after watching too much Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And we were probably 12, 13 years old. And we went to a cemetery across the street from where I lived. I lived in rural Pennsylvania, and so the cemetery was real creepy. Unbeknownst to my friend, we had people waiting in the cemetery to scare the daylights out of him. And we had so much fun that we decided, let's go somewhere where someone's not waiting to scare us. And when strange things started to happen to us, we were like, oh my gosh, ghosts are real. And ever since then, it was just, we were in the school library poring over books about ghosts and reading books by, you know, Hans Holzer and the Warrens, and going out every weekend to traipse through abandoned houses and haunted cemeteries and It just spiraled out of control from there.
And people may not know, but you're a husband and wife team. Now, what's that like to, I mean, I guess, first of all, how did you find each other and found this mutual passion of the paranormal? And what's that like to be kind of a husband and wife team of the weird?
We ran rival websites as kids. We had rival GeoCities ghost hunting websites.
And, I love that.
Hated each other.
I love it.
And I eventually felt really bad. I teased Dana and her friends quite a bit back then, you know, because like it's like kids do. When you have a crush on a girl, you tease them. And I teased her quite a bit. And so 5 years after we stopped talking, I drove to Canada. Just no idea. She wouldn't answer my emails. I had no idea where she lived. I knew the town and where some of them used to work. And I kind of went on this mission to find them. Found them within 45 minutes. And we went on a ghost hunt that night, and that was it.
The
and then after that,
history.
We were ghost hunting,
like
ghost
a true
hunting
stalker.
Team.
I like it. Now, you guys have done so much individually and collectively. It's a little hard to get your arms around. Now, Greg, I know you're a documentarian, and Dana has been on television, if I'm not mistaken, the first all-female paranormal reality show. You have the sites. So briefly tell people kind of like the full scope of what you do, because you guys are prolific.
Go ahead, Dana.
I was just going to say, yeah, I think really for us, for the most part, we kind of are obsessed with all the kind of avenues of the paranormal. So we've been able to actually like sort of go out and explore all of it from, you know, ghost hunting all the way up to the searching for Bigfoot. So we've been really lucky where we've actually, you know, had the opportunities to go and do some pretty amazing things with some pretty awesome people.
Yeah. So, we've always been very careful not to try and pigeonhole ourselves too much into one thing or the other. And so, you know, we do a lot of things. We go out and we hung out with vampires in New Orleans, to see what it was like. And we've hung out with psychics. We've tried to learn psychic abilities. And, you know, we even have a traveling museum that it's got all kinds of haunted objects. It's the only one in the world that travels around and lets people handle and test these things for themselves. So we try and embrace all things weird, not just ghosts or Bigfoot and stuff like that.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you like that, because I think now these days when people say paranormal, they think it's just about ghosts. And to me, paranormal, I kind of have the big tent philosophy. I put everything from UFOs to Bigfoot to just kind of like these head scratching things. I have the big tent philosophy. It sounds like we're kind of similar in that way. It's not just about ghosts.
No, and I think that's the
Absolutely.
Way that's the way that it should be. And hopefully, you know, people who do fall into that big tent theory will start to convince people that it's not just ghosts. There's more weird things out there than just ghosts. And the weird part is these things might all be related.
Yes,
somehow.
I was going to say that. You stole the words out of my mouth, because the thing is, you look at something like Stan Gordon and the research he's done in Pennsylvania, which you know well.
Yes.
With Bigfoot and UFOs. Whitley Strieber was on one of the shows and said that, you know, this abduction phenomenon, he's careful not to call it alien abduction, he calls it the visitors, might have something to do with death. Was something that I mean, I used to think, and you guys are younger than me, but you probably know of the show In Search Of from the 70s. That's when I was a real little kid in elementary school. That's what I started on. And they said, we'll explore UFOs and ghosts and Bigfoot and this and that. I always thought of it kind of that way in my mind. Oh, these are all separate silos. But the longer I do these shows, the more I think that there might be some cross-pollination there, and these things might be connected.
Oh, I think there's no doubt in our minds. The more we do this, the longer we do this. And I'm sure that you've noticed there's an issue in the paranormal community where, and I don't know why, I have an inkling of why, but, you know, Bigfoot hunters don't typically take ghost hunters very seriously.
Right.
Ghost hunters don't typically take UFO hunters very seriously. And maybe it's because, you know, we're looking for strange things and it's easy to get self-conscious. So you always want somebody that's a little crazier than you, maybe. But I really do honestly believe the more that these groups of people start to work together and they use each other's techniques, the more they're going to find that there's all these threads that connect everything they're doing. You know, people who are experiencing Bigfoot habituation sites, you know, they report things that are almost like poltergeist activity happening, sure. And they attribute it to Bigfoot or even, you know, with the UFOs, the people that are experiencing the invisos, you know, the invisible entities that are just like poltergeists, but they don't realize there's so much crossover because, you know, they don't communicate with each other. They don't talk to each other. And I think once they do, we're going to discover some really fascinating things.
No, I completely agree with you. And it's weird because I know a lot of people in the UFO community. I know a lot of people in the ghost hunting community. I know a lot of people, not as many in the cryptozoology community. And then even you have some of the people in kind of the more new agey stuff. And I cover all those topics. But a lot of times they don't know each other. And it almost surprises me. It's like, well, you know so-and-so. No, I don't know him. He's one of those weird UFO guys. You hit it exactly on the head. Well, our guests are Greg Newkirk and Dana Matthews. They are the chief domos at weekandweird.com and also weirdhq.com. And we're going to talk to them more about all stuff weird right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. You know, I like to think that you can find some of the best audio information on the supernatural and metaphysical right here on our podcast. But where do you turn if you want great video documentaries and programs on the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, the unexplained, and more? Well, it's certainly not the mainstream channels you'll find on your cable service. But there is one answer, thankfully, and it is Gaia. Now, I had the privilege to be on George Norrie's show, Beyond Belief, which is a Gaia program, back in the spring, and it opened my eyes to this tremendous network solely dedicated to the topics we talk about here, seeking truth. I immediately signed up to become a paying member, and I've been enjoying it ever since. Now, you know those big movie streaming services that are all the rage? Well, Gaia is like that, but specifically for people just like us and the topics we love. You can explore life's biggest mysteries from specialists in metaphysics, ancient wisdom, the unexplained, on Gaia's exclusive programs. And you'll find hosts like David Wilcock, Regina Meredith, and of course, George Norrie. Now, the topics you'll find on Gaia are engrossing, and they have, they have a lot of everything. It's a treasure trove. Metaphysics, ancient origins, secrets and cover-ups, the unexplained, it's all there. And the best thing is it's so easy to access because you can find Gaia on all of your streaming devices. So the wisdom, information, and entertainment couldn't be easier to access. You'll find Gaia apps on Android, iOS, Apple TV, Chromecast, Roku, and on the web, among many others. Basically, if you're listening to me right now, you can easily tune in to Gaia. And best of all, it's a great time to join. Your first month of membership is only 99 cents, and you can cancel at any time. So to mine the wisdom, be entertained and enlightened, just go to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim to sign up for your first month. Only 99 cents. Heck, you probably have that in your seat cushion, so don't delay. And the thing I really love about this is the fact that with the internet and streaming TV and all these different things, now we can seek out the information that we want. We don't have to wait to be fed by the corporate overlords, you know, these kind of watered down things. You can really get into the material. And for video, there's no place better than Gaia.com. 5,000 years of wisdom now streaming on Gaia. History like you've never seen it. Go to Gaia.com/Jim. To get your first month for only 99 cents. Thanks, Gaia. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guests are Greg Newkirk and Dana Matthews. They are the major domos over at weekandweird.com and weirdhq.com. And they describe themselves as professional weirdos. But I guess I would describe myself as that way too. So I think it all fits. So glad to be a fellow weirdo with you guys. Now, I'm looking here at your page at weekandweird.com. You cover a lot of different things. But right now, what is, and this could be the same answer for you both, or it could be different. What is exciting you now? What case or what area is really floating your boat in the paranormal sense?
Ooh, there's so many.
I know.
The one that I think has been giving us the most thought is we do a lot of work with haunted objects. And there's one that we received earlier this year, and we've been trying to figure it out. It's probably the scariest one that we have dealt with so far. Most of them will behave, I guess I should say. They'll behave when you give them a space, but this one refuses to. We've been calling it the Crone. It's a carved statue, hand-carved. It's clearly pretty old, has rusty nails driven into the eyes and a noose around its neck, and it was discovered in a cave in the Catskill Mountains.
Oh, my Lord. Oh,
it's terrible.
I'm actually looking at it right now, and
it's
pretty disturbing.
I mean, you can tell that the purpose it was created for wasn't very nice.
It's essentially, exactly, it's sure. Like, to me, it almost looks like a variation on the idea of a voodoo doll.
I think that is pretty close to what it is. I think it's more, you know, like Appalachian hill magic, probably. But I think the same idea is there. I almost have a feeling that it was because of where it was found and because of the phenomena that surrounds it. You know, this is where Dan and I part ways a bit. I think it was created to try and summon and contain and use the spirit of a witch is what I think these people were trying to do with it. Dana's thoughts on it are a little bit different.
Yeah, Dana, what do you think?
I think that someone who's probably a magical practitioner was probably using that cave as sort of a sacred space. And that likely it was created almost sort of like the way that we create like gargoyles, for instance, to sort of like ward off either evil spirits or to just basically keep people out of that area. So then, you know, now that it's been taken out of the cave, it's sort of like the equivalent of desecrating a church or desecrating some sort of sacred area.
It's not happy.
No. Which is why it's very grumpy.
So you physically have the Crone now?
Oh, we do. Yeah.
Do you worry about that?
At first, no. I mean, you know, because we have a lot of this stuff. And normally, you know, when we get this stuff, you know, 80% of it never lives up to the reputation that's behind it. You know, the stories that we get are pretty fascinating, but they rarely ever live up to it. And I think that has a lot to do with, you know, whether that the story is an embellishment or, you know, a lot of
whether
these things.
The person.
Yeah, right.
The person itself could have been a trigger for the object, which is why maybe it doesn't, you know, it's not showing any kind of activity once we receive it.
Right.
We didn't expect it to act up the way that it does.
No.
You know, the guys who took it, I mean, they say they started experiencing things almost immediately after they brought it home. The statue was never where they left it. The smells, overwhelming smell of pond water would take over the house.
Yeah, they were finding wet footprints around their home. Their animals were behaving really strange.
What made them send it away? It was very strange in how they contacted us. It was actually a guy who was a production assistant for Finding Bigfoot, who had spent 2 weeks in the van with us listening to our stories, was reading this Reddit thread and suggested he get a hold of us. And I told him, I said, you need to just take it back to the cave and you need to apologize. But he was far too scared to go back to the cave. Mm-hmm. And I said, go ahead. Here's our post office box. You know, send it in. We get weird stuff all the time. The day that it arrived, something pulled Jesus off a crucifix in our office.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I walked in after hearing this crash, this commotion, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. And I almost stepped on Jesus. And when I looked up, his just arm is just swinging on the cross.
Oh, that's frightening.
That's when we knew this one might be a bit different than the rest.
Yeah. I mean, we instantly at that point started to document it and like keep it under surveillance as much as possible. And even then we captured light anomalies sort of trying to manifest around it. And at one point the trail cam that we had set up actually captured it sort of moving half an inch or an inch to, I think, the right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was it's just been the beginning of the activity around this object.
Now, is it to the point that you've considered getting rid of it?
Well, we know we've after it tried to drop a TV on me.
Oh,
it tried to tip a television on my head. That was the point where we realized we had to take action against it. And we do not take that lightly, because I think that making enemies with things that you don't understand is a terrible idea. And so we had to lock it up. We had to start storing it differently. It's one of the only items in the museum that is on the no-touching list. We let most people handle pretty much anything in the museum or test it. This one's off limits. And we know that no matter what, the activity is not going to fully stop until it's taken back to the cave. And that's something that we're going to have to do. At some point, we're going to have to take it back. It's going to be... We have an idea of where the cave is, but it's going to be an issue finding the exact location.
I'd be afraid to ride in a car with it.
Yeah, no, there's, I mean, we haven't had any issues with that. Other items that we drive around with have actually like made us break down. And we've had to get towed. AAA's had to tow us, and they've found nothing wrong with the vehicle. That one's mostly this, we have this African idol that's done that to us a few times, but we found that once he gets rum and tobacco, he's okay. He doesn't do that anymore.
Now, do you believe that haunted objects can transfer a negative spirit to someone if they, you said that you have some non-touching items in the museum, including the crone. Do you believe that actually the act of touching something can make something nasty transfer to you?
I think if you believe it can, it can. I think that, you know, a lot of people ask, what do you do to protect yourselves? And I really think that most of that comes down to intent. I think a lot of the paranormal comes down to intent. And as long as you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that you are protected from these things, most of the time, I think that's enough. That's enough to do it. Mm-hmm. But like I said, there are a few objects that we won't let people handle because they do make us nervous. We've watched how they've affected people. We have a ritual sword that honestly, when we received it, we believed that it was just, you know, a Bible Belt family overreacting at a kid's, you know, right, dabbling in the occult. But Dana actually had to pry this out of a young girl's hands, because when she held it, she just went somewhere else. And mm-hmm. she was walking around the room muttering about killing people and spilling blood.
Oh, my Lord.
She said she felt as if the sword was supposed to be hers. So she was sort of overcome with like this aggression, and she really wanted to sort of like scare people with it. And to give you an example, like she's probably 17 or 18, very sweet, very kind of quiet and mild mannered, and not the kind of person that you would ever think would be violent with a weapon in front of a group of people. And someone, you know, came up to us and was like, you know, this girl is definitely becoming aggressive with it. And I actually had to pry it out of her hands to get her to give it back to us. And after that event, we were like, okay, it's not a good idea to allow anyone to touch this, especially in a group full of people.
Right.
No, I don't disagree with you. One thing I have to ask you about, it's right here on the front page. You talk about the haunted Ouija board that burst in flames. And certainly you could talk about this case. But in general, what are each of your dispositions on Ouija boards? Because I know some people are afraid of them, kind of like me, and other people say, hey, they're just a tool. They can be positive. They can be negative. It's what you bring to it. What do you think?
I think I would go with the latter.
I would agree.
I think it's, you know, it's like it's a telephone. You know, you can call anyone. You can call someone who's not going to like to be disturbed. If you call them in the middle of the night, they're going to be upset about it. But if you set your intentions very well and you go mm-hmm. into it thinking there's a specific spirit in mind, I'm going to contact this spirit, I'm going to talk to this person, or entity, you might have a much better experience. But if you go in willy nilly, and especially if you're scared while you're doing it, you're mm-hmm. probably going to have a scary experience.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, I mean, it just seems of all the things that we talk about on the shows, it has a visceral reaction. People really, there's very few people who are neutral on the Ouija board either.
The truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
It's mysterious, you know? There's no real great answer for it. You know, I know that skeptics like to say, well, it's your ideomotor response and you're just speaking to your subconscious. That's pretty scary still. You're not supposed to speak to your subconscious. Those are things that are subconscious for a reason. And so no matter what you believe, whether you believe that it's just this weird spookiness that's natural, that's kind of scary. If you believe that you're speaking to somebody who's dead, that's scary. If you think you're speaking to demons, that's even scarier. And I think that, you know, no matter what it is, it's always going to be this mysterious thing that we're never going to totally fully understand.
And this is a little bit of a curveball question. What part of the paranormal do you think people don't pay enough attention to? Like something that you think is really fascinating, but like the Ouija board is all over the place. There's movies made, there's books written and everything. What part of all of this, using that big tent theory again, fascinates you guys, but maybe doesn't get the press?
Probably telepathy.
Okay. Dana, what about you?
I was going to say, you know, it's something that we've sort of been a little bit fascinated with, especially over the past couple of years. And it's something that we talk to a lot of people about when we lecture is the green flash the green flash, which is, I mean, and we've experienced it ourselves. People often will experience, especially when they're doing like Bigfoot hunting or they're looking for UFOs, they'll experience this gigantic flash of green light in the sky. And then what follows is something so amazing that would, again, fall underneath the, you know, in the category of the paranormal, whether they have a Bigfoot experience or they see a UFO, that they almost forget that they've seen this green flash because it's, you know, what follows is so mind boggling that they're so focused on that. And we've experienced it a couple different times, actually. And when we've been talking to people over the past couple of years about the green flash and whether they've experienced anything like it, more often than not, a lot of people are like, oh yeah, I have experienced something like that. And it was around the time I had this incredible paranormal experience. So that's kind of like, at least for me, that's something that I've been a bit fascinated with over the past couple of years.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to mention something on that. And I do want to talk with Greg and you a little bit about telepathy, too. But on this green flash, what you just described maps almost exactly to an experience my dad and mom had in about 1970. And I'll share what it is. I've shared it on the shows before, but so you guys know. Now, they described a tremendous flash of, they had driven off to this like secluded, almost, I hate to say it, Lover's Lane area. I don't want to know. But anyway, they drove off to this area. And they saw what they described, and he was driving like a monster of like a late 60s car, a 68 Buick LeSabre, one of those big tanks. And he said that a large flash came across the sky. Now, the only difference is he did not describe it as green, but I've never asked the color. So I'll have to ask him now. And luckily, he's still with us. He's 80 years old. But anyway, big flash of light. Then he turned to his left and he saw what he described. And again, my dad, very salt of the earth. He was a steel worker, you know, certainly not trying to figure out his chakras or get in touch with the oneness of the universe. He turned to his left and he saw a man in a welding mask with his hand sticking out. So my dad left. Wow. And my mom remembers my mom's passed, unfortunately, but she recalled not the guy with the welding mask, but then they left and they described seeing up against the bank, because this was in West Virginia, they described seeing the bank next to the road, the largest birds they'd ever seen in their lives with their wings out, and they were very, very wide. And that almost maps to exactly what you're describing, except for the fact of, was the flash green? I don't know the answer to that. I'm going to ask that today.
The flash, a lot of people have seen, there has been reports of people seeing different colors. Some people even say it's just a big bright light in the sky, but more often than not, it's kind of described as being like an off green. When we saw it, we've seen it a few times. It was the first time we saw it was a very like almost toxic waste kind of green, like, and it was just this enormous flash. But yeah, green tends to be the most common color that people will see, but there have been other reports of different colors as well.
Yeah, it's one of those things when you mention it, it's like, oh my gosh, she's describing exactly what happened to my dad. And I think those stories, and there was another great family story we had about ghosts, that kind of informed my interest in this as a little child. That's why I probably watched In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy and got inspired and ended up doing this for a living, strangely enough. Now, Greg, you were talking about telepathy. Talk to us about telepathy.
I think telepathy is something that people don't take nearly seriously enough. And I think that it informs a lot of the experiences that people have in the paranormal. I mean, a lot of people don't realize this, but telepathy has basically been proven in the lab. They have done tons of testing on telepathy and have proven that in the right conditions, people can, they can send messages back and forth. They can use this extrasensory power that we don't quite realize we have. And I think that the more we do in that, and the more we realize that that is something that's going on, the more we can understand why some people are seeing or experiencing ghosts. You know, there was a really interesting thing that happened with Dana and I. We were leading a ghost hunt on Mackinac Island in Upper Michigan. And we were in this really haunted hotel room, and we had a group of people, and we were all jammed in this hotel room, and we were trying to communicate with a spirit there by the name of Harvey. And one of the things that everyone knows about Harvey is that Harvey, for some reason, when he shows up, he has this very particular scent, and it's the scent of a very strong male body odor.
Mm-hmm. He lived in the room that we were investigating. He had a heartbreak scenario where a girl didn't like him back, and he just sort of shut down and sort of locked himself in his room for weeks and weeks and weeks. So he tends to have a pretty ripe body odor smell that quite a few people have experienced.
But what ended up happening was, all of a sudden, well, this is actually, Dana's the one who experienced it. Why don't you tell Dana?
It was, so we had a big group of people, probably about 12 or 15 people. And we had been investigating for probably about 40, 45 minutes. And out of nowhere, I smell this body odor smell. And it's just like overpowering, like completely, unbelievably overpowering. And I noticed that the lady next to me sort of experienced the same thing. And so since we had been in the room for 40 minutes with the same people, it was such a powerful smell that I know that if it had been one of the people that were in the room with us, we definitely would have smelled it long before the 45 minutes. And she agreed with me, and we asked a couple other people, and it seemed like no one else could actually smell it. It was so overpowering that we were both just like, no one can smell this, and no one else in the group could smell it. So that alone was interesting. And then as we were sort of leading the group back to the main area, she turned to me and dropped this huge bombshell. And she hadn't even thought to say it to me at first, but she said, you know, what's weird about that experience is I actually don't have a sense of smell at all. Like, I'm not capable of smelling anything. And obviously I am perfectly capable of smelling something. And yet we both at the same time smelled the same thing, which is, it's an amazing thing when you really think about it. Well, what does that mean? How do ghosts communicate with us? Are they sort of like triggering things in our brains? It sort of opened up like a whole kind of Pandora's box of questions that we've been a bit obsessed with ever since the experience.
Well, one thing about telepathy, I'll say this, when you look at something like supposed psychic phenomena, now I'm kind of in the camp of being careful about psychics, but not necessarily rejecting them out of hand. I mean, obviously, right, there's some psychics out there who are not really psychics. They're charlatans. I believe that's out there. That's why I think you got to be really careful. Although, on the other hand, I do believe that people do have some real gifts. I don't think there's any question about it. So, for example, my wife was read by a psychic by the name of Carol Obley on one of the shows. Now, when we did this segment, it was a call-in segment just like this one. I had my wife call in, and I didn't tell Carol that we were married. And my wife is very anti-social media, so she's not on Facebook or anything like that. So there'd been no way for her to know anything. And she was doing the reading of my wife, and she said that I'm getting an energy of a young person, kind of your contemporary, This is several years ago. We're not as young as we used to be, but a younger person who died suddenly, and Bob or Robert says hello. Well, the thing is that my wife's best friend in high school was named Bob, and he killed himself. And that was totally out of the blue. Now, I know the thing that the skeptics will say, you remember the hits, you forget the misses, which I think there's some truth to. But boy, was that a hit. I mean, what were the chances that she would get that? Now, but I wonder sometimes, are psychics picking up on something? But is it always somebody from the other side, or are they picking up unintentionally, picking up signals from the person they're reading and maybe having telepathy with that person? And for example, if somebody goes in and says, I'd like to talk to someone, and then the mother comes through, maybe the psychic, unknowing to them, is picking up on the person being read, thinking about their mother. I wonder if that could be a play sometimes.
I think that you're hitting the nail on the head. I think there's more going on with mass consciousness than we think. And I think that some people are better at picking up on that. You know, maybe Dana's experience that she had where she was smelling something and then someone without a sense of smell was smelling it. Maybe they were both picking up on this mass consciousness, you know.
Or maybe I projected it to her because we both knew that people have had those types of experiences before. Maybe I, you know, projected that kind of thought into her own mind, and we both kind of experienced it together.
Yeah.
We're in the middle.
Go ahead.
So go ahead.
No, go.
We're in the middle of a really big 2-year-long experiment right now, where Dana, myself, and another researcher, John Tenney, we've been doing these seances around the country when we've been pulling random people for these. The three of us have picked a person where there is very little to no information about this person online. And the only thing that we're doing is we're showing people his picture. And we're having six completely randomly chosen people meet and do a seance where we have nothing to do with it. They're sitting there and they are supposed to pick up details that only we should know. And they have been stunningly accurate. Now, does that say that they're picking up the intended spirit? Or does that say that they, because we're in the room with them, they're picking up on our brainwave somehow?
Right. Right. No, and kind of the conclusion I've come to over the last 11 years. And, you know, I first started this, I thought I'd do this for 6 months. I'd have all this stuff figured out. That there's definitely something going on. Not everything is paranormal, but some things definitely seem to be. And then third, whatever is going on is not as obvious as we think. You know, ghosts are dead people, or Bigfoot is an animal, you know, which may be the case or may not be the case. It could be an interdimensional traveler. Who knows?
He's a ghost.
whatever is going on in a lot of these instances is something that we don't quite understand yet. And it's not, we try to fit it in our human boxes. And I don't think they fit that well. I think there's a whole other area where it's like a tip of an iceberg. You see the tip and you kind of understand the tip, but you don't understand what's lying below. And I think that's kind of where we're at. What do you think?
I think you're exactly right. And I think the best way we're going to combat that, the best way we're going to get answers is if Bigfoot hunters go ghost hunting, ghost hunters go UFO hunting, and UFO hunters start talking to more psychics. Everybody needs to work together and realize, just like we were talking about earlier, that the paranormal is a bigger tent. It's not these little camps that we've decided to set up in different corners. We all need to meet in the middle of that tent, and we all need to share techniques and help each other out and discuss things without, you know, labeling each other or labeling each other's methods as crazy. Because the fact is, to all the people on the outside, we all look just as crazy.
That's exactly right. But I tell people what I do for a living. They're like, what do you podcast on again? It used to be, you know, the question used to be, what is a podcast? And now the question is, well, what do you do shows on again? When you go to parent night makes interest. Go ahead.
Oh, right. No, that's why we preempt it by saying we're professional weirdos, because then we just get it out of the way.
That's right.
And they know exactly what to expect.
I like that. So what are the professional weirdos doing now? What do you want to tell people about on the sites, and what should they check out?
We've got a lot of events coming up with the Traveling Museum of the Paranormal and the Occult. So if people want to come and see some incredibly haunted, real haunted items, cursed items, and objects of paranormal intrigue. We've got events coming up. People can go to paramuseum.com and see. We're going to be back at Mackinac Island again in October. Mm-hmm. We're going to be at the Mount Washington in November, Gettysburg in December. We've got lots of events coming up. So if people want to come and listen to why we think that Bigfoot is a ghost, we do lectures on that and how to get abducted by aliens, all kinds of fun stuff coming up.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. Our guests have been Greg Newkirk and Dana Matthews. And Greg and Dana, give them all the websites one more time.
They can, if they want to know more about Dana and I, they can go to weirdhq.com. If they want to read daily weird news and things of that nature, they can go to weekandweird.com. And if they want to learn more about the museum and the haunted objects in the collection, they can go to paramuseum.com.
It's a haunted hat trick. Thank you both for joining us today. I appreciate it. And happy weirdness.
Thank you so much
Thank
for having
you.
Us.
Well, that was a lot of fun talking to Greg and Dana about their paranormal partnership. And now we're going to talk to Tony Spera about Ed and Lorraine Warren right after this. Stay close. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Club W. Now, Club W is targeting a new generation of wine drinkers who want to do away with the pretense and simply enjoy reasonably priced great wine. I love it because it's a new way. I used to feel that wine was above me, that it was only for smarter people, for richer people, for people who understood what it meant to say that a wine had nice legs. But now I learn with Club W, I can educate myself about wine, enjoy wine, and actually become knowledgeable about wine with none of the kind of intimidation factor that there used to be. Club W custom tailors wine to the tastes of the individual consumer and delivers three bottles of wine each month to your doorstep for $39 plus a flat $6 shipping rate. And I love the way that they have this set up because you go over to clubw.com/Jim and you sign up to take their 20-second palate profile quiz to get instant wine recommendations based on your unique profile. And the price point for most wines is $20. So by signing up with Club W via the clubw.com/Jim link, you get essentially your first bottle for free because they give you a $25 credit on your first order if you're a new member. So again, Club W is offering our audience members who are 21 and over and who live in the U.S. a $25 credit on their first order and free shipping on four bottles of wine as a new member of Club W. I've really been enjoying their wines, and specifically right now I'm enjoying a 2015 TBT white blend. Delicious. So to receive $25 credit on your first order as a new member, go to clubw.com/Jim. That's clubw.com/Jim. Thanks, Club W. When you talk about paranormal investigation, two figures continually come up as some of the people who did the work in the previous generation, not the generation of ghost hunting TV shows and those kind of things, but further back. Of course, I'm talking about the ghost hunting team of Lorraine and Ed Warren. Now, Ed has passed and Lorraine has retired from active investigation, but we have an interesting guest with us because he is the son-in-law of the Warrens, Tony Spera. He's a paranormal researcher and director of the New England Society for Psychic Research. He also happens to be the curator of the world famous Warren's Occult Museum. Now, Tony worked closely with New Line Cinema in their portrayals of the Warrens for the Conjuring movie franchise, and he's a former police officer and holds an associate degree in law enforcement and also a bachelor's degree from the University of Connecticut. So we're very interested to talk to him about the Warrens and also about the Warrens Occult Museum. Tony Spera, welcome to the program today.
Thank you, Jim. I'm very happy to be with you today.
So I have to ask, your son-in-law, when you first met the Warrens, were you into this stuff or did they kind of introduce you to it?
Well, I was semi into it, Jim. In other words, I was always interested when I was younger in like astrology. I would read books like astrology books. I would read books like, you know, You Were Born Before or There's Life After by different authors, you know, paperback books. So I was into that realm of it, but I was not into the realm actually of ghost hunting until, of course, I met Ed and Lorraine through my wife. And it's an interesting story how I met her. I don't know if you want to go into that or not, but she it was 1979, and I was in a police cruiser looking out at the street from a parking lot, and the car went by, which was her, and I didn't, of course, didn't know her, but she waved and smiled at me, and I said to myself, now, who is this beautiful woman waving and smiling at me, giving a nice smile? And she kept going in the car. So what did I do? 29-year-old police officer, I put it in drive and took off after her behind her to see where she was going. And only about a minute later, she pulled into a strip mall where there was a dress store. She pulls in, and before I could even really get up to her, she's in the store, out of sight. So I pulled up right in front of the door, waiting. And I think I beeped a horn even, maybe. And she came to the window. I didn't know if she worked there. I didn't know if she was a customer. She came to the window, gave me a funny look. She waved, but she gave me a weird look, almost like, what's this guy doing? And then she turned around and went back in the dress shop. So I said to myself, well, I don't know what that was all about, but I'll just forget about that. And I drove off. Not 5 minutes later, another police officer that was working the shift with me in another patrol car calls me on the radio and says, meet me at such and such a location. I met him. He says to me, hey, Tone, did a woman in a brown station wagon drive by you and wave at you? I went, yeah. How did you know, Al? He says, well, she was looking for me. She thought you were me. That's why she was smiling and waving at you. So I said, oh, okay, that tells the story. He says, why, do you want to meet her? He says, I'm not going out with her. I just happen to know her. Do you want to meet her? I said, yeah, I want to meet her after work. And he set it up so I could meet her, and I did. Didn't know who she was. Didn't know it was, you know, Warren's daughter. And we started to date, and about 3 weeks to a month into our dating process, she says to me, do you want to go see my parents' lecture at UConn, University of Connecticut?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what are they, college professors, huh? She goes, no, they're not college professors. They're ghost hunters. They're lecturing at Jorgensen Auditorium tonight. I went, whoa, what do you mean they're a ghost hunter? She goes, the Warrens. Because she had a different last name because she was married previously. So I said, no, you're kidding me, because I knew the name. She says, yeah, those are my parents. You want to go or not? I said, yeah, of course I want to go. And that was October 1979, and that's how I first met Ed and Lorraine in the green room at Jorgensen Auditorium.
Now, and I want to ask you about them personally, but really what made them so unique in this whole area? I mean, we got to remember it's before all of these TV shows and things. How did they get into it, and what made them unique? What did they do that nobody else did?
What made them unique was the fact that Ed Warren lived in a haunted home in Bridgeport, Connecticut, from age 5 to age 12. When he was a young boy, he was so frightened to come home from school because of the phenomena that would happen to him and his twin sister, Babe. He would come home at 7, 8 years old. Sometimes in the wintertime, he'd come home. He'd see that there's no lights on. It was kind of dark when he got home. He'd see there's no lights on in the apartment, in the house on Jane Street in Bridgeport. He would actually hide under these vegetable carts, these abandoned vegetable carts that the old Italian guys used to have with vegetables in the summer, selling their produce, but they're abandoned with like a sheet over them, and he would hide under there he'd peek out until he saw a light go on in the house. That's how frightened Ed was. When Ed turned 17, he joined the U.S. Navy during World War II, and he was already dating Lorraine. He dated Lorraine. He met her at 16. He said to Lorraine, when I get out of the Navy, I'm going to find out if people had the same kind of problems I had living in that haunted house in Bridgeport.
Mm.
And Lorraine at the time, Lorraine was, 17, too, she said, oh, Ed, come on, that's not real. All these people that you're talking about that have all these instances happen to them, they're all reading the same books. She didn't even believe in ghosts and stuff at the time. But she knew at that time that she was psychic because at age 9, she was going to an all-Catholic girls' school called Laurelton Hall in Milford, Connecticut. And at that age 9, one day, she's in line with her friends, and she looks and sees Mother Superior, and then next to Mother Superior, she sees Sister Joseph. And she says to the girl next to her, she says, "Look, Sister Joseph's lights are brighter than Mother Superior's lights."
Hmm.
And Mother Superior, and she was looking at the human aura that surrounds everybody that's alive, that God has created. Anything that God created that's alive has an aura, of tree, plants, animals, you, me. And Mother Superior overheard her say that. She walked up to Lorraine and says, "Lorraine, what are you talking about, lights around people? What's that? That we don't talk like that around here in this place. You're staying after school and praying." So Lorraine, at that time, thought that the girl next to her and every other girl could see the lights. She didn't think she was any different. But unbeknownst to her, she was actually having a psychic episode there because she was seeing the human aura around people. So fast forward a little bit. When Ed got out of the Navy, and when he was about 20 years old, he went to art school for 2 years. He used to do all these paintings of not nautical scenes, but New England scenes and haunted houses that he read about. He would read about a haunted house in Fate magazine, and he'd paint it from his memory or from the description that he read or from a picture. And he went 2 years to art school, came home one day, like at age 21 or 22, and says to Lorraine, "Hey, I quit art school today." She says, "What are you talking about, you quit art school?" He said, "I can paint better than those instructors can." He was kind of cocky back then. And he said, "I'm just going to sell my own paintings. We'll make a lot of money. We'll just sell them." So what he did, he had a thought. "I'll get these old pieces of barn wood, and I'll paint these New England scenes on these pieces of brown barn wood."
Right.
Rustic looking. And that's what he did. He'd take little pieces of wood, or he'd even use little porcelain plates. And he'd drive around with Lorraine in a 1933 Chevy that he bought after he got out of the service. They bought for $15. Still have it today. It's in the garage, all restored.
That's
great. All restored in the garage. He drove that all the way up through Maine, through New Hampshire, Vermont, all the tourist areas. And they would stop at the side of the road. He would open the trunk or open the doors up, put all the paintings out, and sell them. So I said one time to Ed, "Hey, Ed, did you make a lot of money doing that back in the early 50s and stuff?" He goes, "Oh, yeah, I made it." And he laughed. He goes, "I made an exorbitant amount of money." I go, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Oh, I was rich." I go, "What do you mean?" He says, "I get big bucks." I said, "Well, what are you saying, big bucks? What do you mean, big bucks?" He says, "Sometimes I'd sell a painting for maybe $4 or $5. I started to laugh.
Right.
I said, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "Tone, if I sold five of those paintings at $25 on me, hot dog was 10 cents for a hot dog. A gallon of gas was 28 cents. We used to stay up in Vermont in a cabin, Lorraine and I, for a dollar a night. If I had $25, I was bucks up." So I said, "Yeah, you know what, Ed, you're right. Everything's relative." So he laughed. That's how he got into ghost. And it's funny, Jim, because that's how he got into ghost investigating. And it sounds weird, the transition from being an artist and painting to going into haunted houses. What he would do, he got smart. He read these articles in Fate magazine. He'd say, "Okay, we're going up and finding that place." He'd drive up with Lorraine and park in front of that haunted house, take out a sketch pad and a pencil. He'd sketch the house right there. Take him 25 or 30 minutes maybe to make it really look good. And then he'd hand the sketch to Lorraine. She's 20, 21, 22. "Lorraine, go up to the door, knock on it, tell whoever answers the door that your husband made a nice sketch of your house and he wants you to have it. Maybe that'll get us in to talk to these people about their haunting." And that's exactly how it started. She would go up, talk to the folks, and all of a sudden you'd see her waving Ed from the street to come on up from the car. "Come on up, Ed." He'd go in there and say, "Oh, yeah, I'm an artist." He'd start talking. Then he'd say, "Hey, I kind of heard about your house. It's being haunted. What happened?" And then he'd learn what their phenomena was, what happened to them. So that is basically how they got started way back.
Now, we have to remember, because I think now, everybody and his brother is a paranormal investigator or claims to be one. And I kind of make a joke. It's almost like bowling teams used to be. Everybody's got the shirts and have their paranormal team and those kind of things.
Right.
But this was pretty much unheard of back then, wasn't it?
It was very unheard of. There's only a few people even doing it. People like Hans Holzer and people like that. And so Ed was one of the, actually, Ed and Lorraine were the pioneers. Because you remember, Jim, that they founded the New England Society for Psychic Research in 1952. That was prior to any TV show. TV was brand new. There were no ghost hunting shows. There were no ghost clubs. There was no internet where anyone can go on and say, I'm a demonologist, I'm a psychic, I'm an investigator. Ed was one of only seven recognized religious demonologists in the nation back then in the late 60s. And the other six were clergy. He was the only lay demonologist. And it's because of his training, it's like on-the-job training, and his all the books he used to read, and living in a haunted house himself, and his religion, his faith that God is the solution to a lot of these problems in these haunted houses, especially if it's demonically infested. If it's got an evil spirit, demonic spirit, you have to have religious intervention. You can't deal with it. Ed couldn't deal with it alone. Lorraine couldn't. You couldn't. I could. Has to have someone with the authority from God, like an ordained member of the clergy, you know, priest, minister, rabbi, any one of those kinds that can go in and say certain rituals to expel these spirits. But yeah, Ed was one of only seven, and they were ridiculed. You're right. When they were doing things at colleges in the early to late 60s, Ed would be talking, Lorraine would be talking for 2 hours on their experiences with ghosts, showing slides, talking about these various cases that they were on, how the dangers of evil spirits. At the end of the lecture, they'd always have a Q&A, question and answer. So many times, people would raise their hand to Ed and say, do you really believe in this stuff? You really believe in ghosts? After 2 hours of talking about their belief in ghosts, they would say, do you really believe in this stuff? Come on, isn't this a bunch of hokey stuff? And Ed would get mad. Ed would say, look, pal, I just got through talking to you about my life experiences for 2 hours, and now you're questioning if I believe in ghosts? Of course I believe in ghosts. Ghosts are spirits. If you believe in God, who's a spirit, and made us, then you believe that there are spirits. You're a spirit, he would say to the guy. So yeah, they took the ridicule back then, Jim.
Well, I want to talk to you in a little bit after the break about how they made the transition from being the ones who had to draw paintings to being the people who folks called when they had an infestation of spirits or ghosts. We'll be back with Tony Sparrow right after this on the Paranormal Podcast.
If you enjoy adult coloring books, check out the True Ghost Story adult coloring book inspired by Jim's Campfire podcast and books. Creepy Coloring Fun, created by illustrator Len Peralta. Find it at Amazon, or for the direct links, go to jimharoldbooks.com. Now, back to the show.
Our guest is Tony Sparrow. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast, and we're talking about Ed and Lorraine Warren. Tony is their son-in-law. He is also the curator of the Warren's Occult Museum, and he's telling us all about the Warrens today. Tony, what was the transition? You know, you talked about how Ed and Lorraine used paintings to get into houses to investigate that they found out about. How did it change where, instead of them approaching other people, people started to approach them?
Right. Good question, Jim. Now, let me say first, before we go on to that, I've had people that I read on little blogs that would criticize the fact that Ed would draw a painting of a house to get in. They thought that was hokey. See, people who don't believe in spirits or ghosts will always try to condemn those who do. They don't have a belief in spirits because they don't believe in God. They'll always condemn ones who try to explain it. So whatever Ed did, it was wrong to them. Oh, boy, that's what kind of hokey stuff is that, making a painting of a house and then trying to get in there? And they would criticize even that thing that I just told you about. And that was Ed's way of getting it to learn. But those people didn't want to hear that. They used to be skeptics. But to get back to the question was, how did they get to have people come to them rather than they come to the people? Well, paintings again. Ed was doing a gallery showing of his paintings in his own town of Monroe, in a little section of Monroe. Now, Monroe itself has only got about 23,000 people, maybe. But in that little section, there's a section of it called Stepney. And in fact, that's where the creativity came in the movie Stepford Wives came from. I guess one of the writers lived in Monroe or near it, and he created that movie, The Stepford Wives. But anyway, to get back, he was having a gallery showing of his paintings with a little paragraph underneath the painting of what it was. So at the end of the showing, a young man came up to Ed and said, Mr. Warren, That was really, really intriguing. That was really great. How would you like to come to our school and talk about your experiences with ghosts and haunted houses? Ed looks at him and says, son, you know, I'll tell you what, I'm not really a public speaker. I don't really do that kind of thing. I'm more of an artist. I don't like to get up in front of people. And the young man, not young, he's probably in his 20s, he says, well, I'll give you $300. Ed says, when do I start? That was Ed. 1967, about. 1960. Now, $300, somebody's going to hand you $300 for speaking for an hour on something you love. Pretty good money, you know? So he goes, he pulls into the school. Now, Lorraine is with him, but she's not going to speak. She's just going along for the ride. You know, Ed's the speaker. He pulls into the parking lot. There's 900 cars, there's 1,000 cars in there, lots of cars. And Ed says, Lorraine, geez, there must be a basketball or something, football game or something going on. Look at all these cars. She goes, yeah, honey, must be. They pull in. There's no basketball game. There's no football game. They're all there to see Ed Warren, about 900 people in the audience. So I said to Ed later, I said, Ed, how the heck did you do it? You never spoke that before. He goes, man, I'll tell you, all I did is stand up, look behind the last person's head, looked at the wall, and just started to talk about my experiences, and I got through it. So he does it. He gets the $300, figures it's over. Then about, and Lorraine made a little passbook account because she thought it was funny, Ed Warren's speaking fund, and she gave him a little passbook savings account, thought it was cute. So she hands it to him, and he's got his $300. But a month later, another call comes in from just some stranger. The guy's with a school. And he says, Ed, and Mr. Warren, I heard that you did a great job speaking about those hauntings. It was really intriguing. It was really great. We'd like to have you at our school. And Ed says, well, you know, like I told the first guy, you know, I just did it at one time. I don't guess I'll give you $500. Ed says, when do I start? So he goes. He does $500 lecture. This is in the 60s, so it's a lot of money.
Sure.
So he gets the money again. Lorraine puts it in the passbook account, hands him the money. Now he's got $800 of his own money that she thinks is cute. So it's over. There's no more. That's it. He knows there's not going to be any more lectures. Well, about a month and a half later, another phone call came in, another college. And this time the guy says, Ed, we want you to come to our school and speak at the college about your experiences. And Ed says, you know, I did it twice. I'm getting a little tired of it. The guy says, we'll give you $1,500. Ed says, when do I start? And he did. He did it. Now, the funny part about this whole thing is that Lorraine, when she heard about the $1,500, she said, Ed, that's no longer your little college passbook fund. Give it back. It's ours. Now it's ours, not yours. So that was the funny part about that. But the thing that catapulted them, they started to do lectures now on things about their about some of the investigations they were on. And I remember he was doing a lot of local investigations because people heard about the gallery showing. They knew he'd investigated haunted houses. So someone would call him and say, Mr. Warren, you know, I know you do this for a living, or not for a living, but I know you do this, you investigate haunted houses. So Ed would go on these local calls around Connecticut to people who had a problem. What catapulted them was, you know, I told you he was doing these lectures.
Right.
And when now it became in the 1970s now. Now he's doing more investigating. He's going farther out. He's going to Pennsylvania. He's going to New York. He's branching out. He and Lorraine are branching out. But what happened one day was West Point Military Academy called the house. And the guy on the other line says, General Knowlton wants you to come to West Point and investigate a ghost we have in a dorm. And Ed says, what? You mean a ghost at West Point Military? Yes, but you can't tell anybody you're coming. We're a military place, a government installation. We don't want that spreading around. And while you're here, can you talk about some of your experiences? Mm-hmm. And Ed says, sure, we'll do it. They went out there. They investigated. Lorraine picked up that there was a young man who passed away way back in the 1850s. A cadet who was haunting that dorm. And so that was done. Ed didn't tell anybody. Lorraine didn't tell anybody that they went to West Point. The problem was they did another college lecture in the 70s. And at this college lecture, at the end of it, a woman raised her hand in the audience and says, well, why don't you tell us about the West Point ghost? And Lorraine froze up. She didn't know what to say. Come to find out, that lady who raised her hand in the audience was the mother of one of the cadets that was at the academy when they came. And she blurted it out. All the newspaper wires, the AP, the UI wires, all got a hold of that story. and they were inundated for over 24 hours with phone calls, book offers, you name it. For, you know, the Warrens went to West Point. They investigated a ghost at the West Point military camp, and it spread like wildfire. So everybody now knows the name Warren. They had book offers. And so that's basically how they got catapulted and where people were calling them more and more.
Now, there are critics and there are people out there that say, I mean, you told the stories about the speaking fees and so forth. And there are people that say, well, there was the profit motive. And then other people, you know, I've heard people say that maybe some of the Warren's participation in a case like the Conjuring case, the Enfield case, was exaggerated. What do you say to the critics of the Warren?
Okay, number one, I would say this. They got speaking fees. They got book fees. But they never got a fee for investigating a house. So imagine yourself and your wife going out when someone calls you and says, hey, I live in Pennsylvania, and I got this bad case, this bad thing happening to me, and Ed and Lorraine drop everything, go to the house, spend all their own money on gas and lodging, get there, spend 2 or 3 days there, maybe more. Sometimes people don't even offer them a cup of coffee. They have to leave and go to a diner or something to get a cup of coffee.
Wow.
Because people are poor and never charge them. So how do you keep doing that when you never charge the families? So what's wrong with doing a lecture on your experiences and people are wanting to hear it, and so you get a fee? And everybody gets a fee for doing something.
That's right. Well, I mean, frankly, I will tell you my personal experience. I've had people, this is my full-time job doing these shows,
right,
and doing my books. And people will say, oh, yeah, how dare you do this? And then we have some shows that people can purchase extra shows, and people will critique me. And I had someone say, oh, I know what it was. They said something about, we take advertisers on this show. But I've turned down thousands of dollars worth of advertisers I didn't believe in. But anyhow, I had somebody, and you have too much advertising on your show, and they signed it, and it was their business. And I'm like, oh, I see. You do your work for free.
I do believe
that these things were important to get out, but everybody has a job, and this happens to be my job. So I can relate to that.
Yeah, and the thing is, Jim, like I said to you before, no matter what you do, if someone doesn't believe in ghosts or they want to make you less credible, or they want to debunk you, you're going to bring stuff like that up all the time. Well, geez, okay. And if you say, we don't charge you go on our investigation, yeah, but don't you get money from books? Don't you get money for speaking fees? Of course. How do you keep investigating? What are they going to live on? Dust? They live on gravel? I mean, you have to get an income somehow. And remember, Ed wasn't seeking out, especially in the beginning. He wasn't seeking out trying to go to a lecture. They were coming to him saying, can you talk about your experiences? Because most people are very, very interested in the spirit realm, the afterlife. Do we survive death? Like Ed used to say all the time, you know, where did we come from? Why are we here? And where are we going after death of the physical body? Now, isn't that an intriguing question? Don't people want to know? Yes, but the only people who don't want to know are the people who don't believe in God. If they don't believe in God, all they believe in is that they have 6 feet of dirt waiting for them when they die. Now, that's a sad way to feel. That's just like when you ask somebody who doesn't believe in a higher power that created us, well, how do you think we got here, sir? Well, I don't know, but it wasn't God. Well, how was it? I don't know, a Big Bang Theory. And so a theory that's so out of like the realm of anything that's rational, like particles of dust banging together and causing all this miracle of life, this recreation of life. And all you have to do is look out to the woods and look at a deer feeding its young. Like Ed said one time, he was driving down the road and he saw this mother deer pull the branch down, a pine branch, pull it way down so the female deer can get it. Or they create the miracle of life when something is born. And people don't believe that there's a higher power. So how do you ever explain anything to those kind of people? And there are a lot of them. Trust me, there's a lot of people, Jim, that are atheists that totally don't believe in God at all. So those are the ones that give the big problems to us by trying to like debunk anything we say.
Right. Well, the thing that I feel, I mean, certainly it's a right to anybody to believe and not believe. And actually, pretty much my best friend is an atheist. I don't get it. I don't agree with it. I'm like, right. How can you look at those? But you can be a good person, and I think, and be an atheist. I think there, to me, there's, and I'm not going to take credit for this, a gentleman by the name of Scotty Roberts said this, and I agree with him totally. There's two kinds of skeptics. There's skeptics with a little S, and there's skeptics with a big S.
Right.
And you know what? You got to watch how you say that, too. People misunderstand what you're saying. But but skeptics with a big S, it doesn't matter. You could, you know, you could have a ghost walk up and shake hands with him. But then you've got the skeptics with the little S, which I understand, because I think it's good to be skeptical sometimes.
Now, I'm glad you brought that up for a second, Jim, because everything I told you, and I said how Ed believed in ghosts and everything, but Ed was skeptical when he walked into a house. Not that he didn't believe in ghosts. He believed 1,000% in the spirit realm. But he was skeptical if these people that he was visiting had an experience or not, because a lot of these people that would call them up, and even today, try to debunk you. In other words, they made up the story. So if someone made up the story totally and Ed believed everybody's story, how long would it be until someone came out with, like today, would come out with a blog, come out with an article, well, these guys are charlatans. They believe everything they're told. You know, I had nothing happening. I made the whole story up, and they took it hook, line, and sinker. So you have to know what you're talking about, and you have to know what questions to ask when you go into a haunted home. You don't just walk in and people say, you know, I had a ghost grab me by the neck. The, oh, geez, that's crazy. That's bad. Without asking more questions and trying to get to the root of what's going on in the house. So, yeah, Ed was a true believer, but he entered as a skeptic when he walked in.
Now, these days, when somebody goes on a ghost investigation, a paranormal investigation, they have all this equipment and all this technology that we have today.
Right.
Did the Warrens start incorporating technology of the day, which was quite different, into their investigations?
Yes. Yes, believe it or not, Jim, not on a whole jar, but believe it or not, Ed used to bring a big open reel tape deck with him, the reel-to-reels.
I know what those are.
Yeah, I have one of his. I have one of his in my barn. He has an old Akai tape deck that he used to go with a microphone and interview the people in the house. Like he used that exact tape deck that I have to interview the Gooden family in Bridgeport, 966 Lindley Street. If anybody wants to hear about a pretty good haunting, just Google 966 Lindley Street in Bridgeport. And that was 1974. And that was really, really a harrowing experience for everybody involved. Hold on one second. What? Yeah, and so the thing is that, and he'd use cassette players. He would use cassette recorders and players and regular cameras. He would use a regular camera with a flash, and that would be it. So, yes, they used the stuff of the day. Ed never got to use digital photography because the digital photography really wasn't in vogue.
Sure, wasn't basically invented.
Right, and remember this too, Jim, is that it's not the equipment really that you need. It's your knowledge that you need and your faith in how to deal with it. The problem with the shows today, with just about every show that I can think of, I don't watch them because to me they're just too fake, is that they're doing half of an investigation. They go in, they're supposedly trying to document and gather evidence that there's things happening. Now, that's a normal method of operation for an investigator. Try to find out what's going on, document it, and do your reports, any photography, any EVPs you get. But the other thing is, what are you going to do with those photographs, EVPs, and interviews? They don't do anything with them. They leave and they go on to the next case. The problem is, they're doing half their job, but they're supposed to try to find a resolution for the family who called them in the first place. The family didn't come in for confirmation that it's happening. They're calling in because they need help to get rid of it. That's the problem with all these shows. Ed and Lorraine always wanted to gather the evidence so they can bring it to the proper authorities, which in 99.9% of the cases, or all of them, was the clergy. Because if there's a demonic entity there, you need the clergy. If there's a human spirit that's lingering, an earthbound spirit that's lingering in a home, you need a clergy to bless the house and maybe have a deliverance done, and so the person knows to go towards the light, the spirit. Because some people, earthbound spirits, are very confused. You know, they maybe they didn't believe a lot in God when they were younger, when they were living, or maybe they're confused, maybe they were murdered tragically, and they're confused as to what happened to them, or they're the kind of person who likes to cling to their belongings in life. They're so selfish, and they work so hard for all this stuff. They want to stay around their stuff. They don't want to leave the house, and they're mad when somebody new moves in. So maybe you need some kind of a blessing of the house. It's never just walking in and walking out, because now you're not doing your job. It's like a police officer walking into a burglary, and the house is all in disarray, and there's the checkbooks are stolen, and the TV's gone, and the cop says, "Yep, you had a really pretty bad burglary here," and he walks out and never follows up.
Well, that's interesting. I've never heard that take on it. That's a very interesting take. Now, let me ask you this. Do you think that there is a active movement to take the kind of the other side of it, kind of the God side out of this? For example, I interviewed, and I won't mention a name, for one of my plus shows, I interviewed a nice guy, and he's a paranormal investigator. He's written books, but he's an atheist. Right. So do you, which again, doesn't mean he's a bad person, but I just thought that was interesting. Do you think there's kind of the thrust is to take the whole God piece out of it in that follow on from clergy and those kind of things?
I do. And that person you're speaking about, I don't know who he is. But that's like a lawyer being an attorney and not believing in the law. You know, that, to me, that's what that's like. It's like being an attorney, but you're not believing in any law that you're trying to argue at all. So to me, it's foolish to someone to be a paranormal. Well, let me back up. I know why he's doing it. He's trying to find evidence. And so far, in his mind, he hasn't found the right evidence for him to say, yeah, there are spirits. He would have to see a full-blown manifestation in a house. He's all alone. He walks in the house and he sees a full-blown manifestation of a ghost. He might at that point believe it's real, or he might just say, oh, well, I had a bad imagination or something. I maybe had a bad piece of meat or something, and it screwed up with my mind. So, yeah, I know what he's saying, but he's the kind of guy that would never help a family because he wouldn't know how. How's he going to help the family? By setting up cameras? You know, I mean, so the thing is, yeah, I know what you're saying. And a lot of people are trying to take, well, look at the reality shows. How many people even mention God's name in these reality shows or tells the same family to start praying? How many? I don't know, but I don't think there's hardly any that say, well, why don't we do this? Why don't we get a priest in here? You'll never see a priest walking in the house doing a blessing because these shows are fake. These shows don't know what they're doing. The investigators don't know what they're doing. They're approaching it all from the wrong angle, and that's why there's never any resolution. They don't ever show a resolution that I know of where the people are like, geez, slapping the guy in the back. Boy, you really helped me. Boy, it's gone now. Thank you so much. You never see that because they don't know what they're doing. They're doing half the job. It's like a heart surgeon opening up a patient. He looks at the heart. He says, that's damaged. And then he leaves. He doesn't try to fix it. So, you know?
That's interesting. It's an interesting perspective and one that I've not heard a lot, and I've been doing these shows for 11 years. So it's an interesting perspective. Now, at the end of the day, now, of course, Ed Warren has passed and Lorraine is retired from the field. But did they come to any conclusions on this? It sounds like, I mean, we're kind of hinting at a lot of this. But what was their conclusion? What was going on with these hauntings? Was it different things in different cases? What were some of their thoughts on that?
Yeah. There are different things in different cases, but there's only basically two kinds of spirit hauntings, basically. But there's elemental spirits, too. So, yeah, there's other kinds of spirits, but basically we'd be dealing with an earthbound entity, someone who maybe died in a house or lived there at one time and just keeps coming back because they liked that place the most in life, like I explained before about confusion, or they wanted to stay in their belongings. And the other is demonic. The other is a demon or a devil, which are very real. People say devils and demons aren't real. All of the evil that happens in our world, I believe, that's me only, I'm just telling from my perspective, believe that it's demonically influenced. 9/11, demonically influenced. People raping little children, killing them, murders, rapes, all those disgusting things are demonically influenced. Now, maybe the devil's not in that person, but they could have influenced their thinking. They could be oppressed. They could influence how these people are thinking. I mean, how does a person murder 9, 10, 11, 12, 15 people, and then they go to trial, and they go, well, he had a psychiatric exam, and he's sane.
Right. Yeah, no, it does. You know, the funny thing is, I've got to say this, Tony, is that I will interview a lot of New Age people for some of my shows, and they're nice people, and I think they've got some very good points. But then I'll pose the question to them, is there good and is there evil? And yeah, they'll say, oh, no, there's just a lower level of spiritual vibration. And I'm like, I don't know. What about see Hitler, see John Wayne Gacy, see Jeffrey Dahmer. I don't think they
Ed
were
Bundy.
Just. Yeah, exactly.
Hitler.
Yeah,
Hitler.
Exactly.
See, Hitler is a bad spirit. Now, that's the thing. There's also evil human spirits, because you take a guy like Adolf Hitler, probably the most disgusting guy who ever lived in recent times. When he died, he doesn't have any power on his own, by the way, to hurt anybody else, to kill anyone else. But he could be in league with a demonic. In other words, demonic entities would try to go to him and say, let's work together. I know it sounds crazy, but it's true. In other words, they know that Hitler wanted to do a lot of bad things on Earth. That's what the devil's whole goal is to destroy us, because the devil hates us because we're made in God's image, and that's a hated image to the demonic. So if they can employ a human spirit to go against God like Hitler and say, let's cause some havoc, how do we know? I mean, how do we know they didn't influence some of the bad stuff that's happened in recent times with a guy like Adolf Hitler's spirit trying to conjure up different crazy scenarios of havoc and trauma and pain to people, like the 9/11 attack? They were demonically influenced in their brain. Something influenced their brain to pull something like that. So that's the evil influence I'm talking about. It's not a guy in a red suit running around stabbing people. It's the influence they have on your thoughts. They oppress your thoughts, and thoughts that aren't your own are happening to you. And some weak people who don't have a strong will or strong mind will be susceptible to that kind of stuff. And that's what happens to people, because, like I said, how can they be deemed perfectly sane and then do some of the traumatic heinous things that they do?
It seems pretty horrible stuff that is out there, and something's going to cause it. Now I want to talk a little bit before we leave today, and it's been a fascinating discussion. Tell us a little bit about the Warren's Occult Museum.
Okay, the Occult Museum was founded way back when Ed founded the Society for Psychic Research. Now remember, Jim, it's just kind of another crazy throwback to painting. That museum used to be an art studio that Ed built. He built that place, that building, that structure, to be an art studio so he could teach art. Ed used to give, and Lorraine, he taught Lorraine how to paint, and then they would both together give art classes. They would charge like $5 or $10 for an hour lesson, have people come in with their easels, and they would show different ways to how to paint. And so Ed did that for a while, but when he started to really get busy with the investigations and his photographs that he would take and these reports that he would make, one day he was sitting on the floor with Lorraine, this is back in her early 50s, and he says, Lorraine, we have to do something. She goes, what do you mean? He says, look at all this stuff strewn around the floor, all these documents, these manila folders. We got to start a society or something. So that's what he did. He started a society in 52. But he was starting to collect artifacts from these hauntings also. He was putting them in a box and just leaving them in a box somewhere. Finally, he says, you know what, Lorraine? I think we've got to convert that art studio into like a museum or something, because I have no place to put all this stuff. And that's what he did. He said, let's make it an occult museum. Then instead of teaching painting, we'll be teaching people about the occult. When they come in, we could show them the evidence we have, you know, and we could discuss different cases of some of the artifacts that I collected. And that's what he did over the years. He would collect some fascinating artifacts like the Annabelle doll, like the satanic idol, like the conjuring mirror, like the creature that floated across the room in Brookfield. There's a book on it called Devil in Connecticut that it would float across the room and said, you are all going to die. Many a shadow doll. There's many, many artifacts that he would collect from cases and from people who perhaps dabbled in witchcraft. And all of a sudden, something really bad happened in their house. And they got freaked out, and they called Ed and says, you know, I got this statuette, and I got this book on the occult. I don't want it anymore. And Ed would say, well, bring it to me. I'll keep it in a safe place, and he'd put it in the museum. Or someone would go to a tag sale, Jim, and buy, like, a statue, a painting, anything, a doll. And that night, they would see a shadow out of the corner of their eye. They would hear a knocking sound. they would feel the presence of something watching them that same night. And they would immediately, just like I would, attribute it to that item I just bought at the tag sale or estate sale. So they'd call up Ed and say, I got this doll and I'm freaked out about it. Something's going on in this house and I don't like it.
Right.
Give me the doll. And it would take, that's how he would acquire these objects.
Now, if folks want to find out more, if they want to find out more about the occult museum, and I assume, is it open for people to come see it, correct?
It's not open at the moment. We're working on getting it reopened. But right at the moment, it's not open because of a zoning issue. But we're hoping to either get that resolved or to move it to another location that's more appropriate. Because it's right on the property right now.
There
and we get so many artifacts that we need to expand it. But if they want to know more, they can just go to www.warrens.net.
Warrens.net.
Warrens.net. And also, Jim, we have, my wife is making these bracelets of Lorraine's jewelry, pieces of Lorraine's old costume jewelry, and she's selling them to benefit Lorraine's favorite animal charities. Lorraine and Ed, remember, were gigantic, gigantic animal lovers. I've never seen people who loved animals so much except my wife. She loves more than me. And Judy came up with a great idea. Lorraine wasn't wearing all this costume jewelry she bought over the years, and I mean boxes and boxes. So Judy would take pieces of those broken bracelets and broken beads and things, put them together and put a little tag on it that says Lorraine Warren on it, and sell them to people who want them, women, and give all the 100% of the proceeds to animal charities like Wildlife in Crisis here in Connecticut, which is a fabulous place, or the New Milford Animal Shelter that we have here right in my town, or Best Friends Animal Sanctuaries, because Lorraine and Ed, that's all they really were passionate about the animals.
So and they can find that over at warrens.net as well?
Yeah, or they can send me an email and I can tell them about it. I don't think it's really it's not listed right now on warrens.net because we're not trying to hawk this stuff. But we are trying to make a little money for the animals because, they're our friends, and it's an honor. It's an honor for Lorraine. It's honoring Lorraine and honoring Ed's memory because Ed was such an animal. He had a fox, He used to have a pet fox.
Huh.
And I know you're running out of time, but really, really quick story, if I could, Jim. He had this fox. He named it Red. Red Fox.
Yeah.
And he used to have it in his car and everything, and he would have it drive around with it. So one day he says, this is back in the in the early 60s, he says to Lorraine, hey, I got to go to the store. I'm going to take Red with me, but I'll be back. He gets in the car with Red, the fox, and they go to the grocery store, wherever Ed went. Now, Lorraine's getting upset, not upset, but scared, a little nervous, because about an hour and a half later, Ed's not back, and he's always back early. Finally, the phone rings. Says, remember, no cell phones or anything. Phone rings at her house. Ed's frantic. Lorraine, get down here right away. Get down here right away. What's the matter, Ed? What's the matter? That damn fox won't let me back in the car. This fox is snapping at him because the fox was a wild animal.
Right.
Fox snapping at him. Lorraine had to go drive in her other car, go meet Ed, and go on the passenger side, hi, Red, and trying to get Red's attention so Ed can jump in the car.
Oh, that's funny. That's a funny story. Well, it has been a very interesting time we've been able to spend with Tony Spera. He is the head of the NESPR, the New England Society for Psychic Research, and the curator of the Warrens Occult Museum. Tony, thank you for your time, and thanks for being a part of the Paranormal Podcast today.
Thank you very much, Jim. It was very enjoyable. Thank you.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed this special edition of the Paranormal Podcast as much as I did, a little bit of Halloween treat, not a trick. And I hope that you'll join us again. And please, if not now, when? Tell a friend. Everybody's in spooky mood. You can say, look at this treasure trove of content that you can get for free over at jimherold.com with our Paranormal Podcast program and Jim Harold's Campfire, perfect for the spooky season. Take their phone, actually say, hey, let me show you this. Let me point this out. Let me subscribe you for free. With their permission, of course. It is the perfect time to introduce the podcast to people. It's also a perfect time to check out my Campfire books. In fact, Campfire 1 for just the next few days is only 99 cents on the Kindle. Hey, maybe get it as a gift for a friend for Halloween. 99 cents on the Kindle. And you don't need a Kindle to read a Kindle book. You can use any of the free Amazon apps that are out there. Of course, we have our big Halloween sale. jimherold.net for our Paranormal Plus Club. Check that out. And always make sure you join our virtual campfire group for free over at Facebook. So there's a lot of things to do. Hey, it's the busy season. It's the Halloween season. I hope that you have a happy, healthy, and most importantly, safe Halloween, because we want you to be back next week, because guess what? Everybody's going to pack up the Halloween decorations, but it's always Halloween here at the Paranormal Podcast. We'll talk to you next time. Have a great week, everybody. A great holiday, and stay spooky. Bye-bye.
Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to jimherold.com, and thanks for listening.